Senate is now in session. We have a quorum present, that being Senators Ellis, Pierce, Miller, Chair Taylor. The bill before us is Senator Halford's SB 219, and Senator Halford is also present. At the conclusion of the last hearing on this bill, efforts were being made to draft amendments and to do some further work on the bill. Senator Halford, could you give us an update as to where that process is?
I'll give you in a minute.
All right. I think we have it. I think we've distributed those to the packet.
Okay. That amendment deletes the subpoena of a judge or a jury member, which was, I think, what your concern was. And I support that amendment. I believe that it doesn't mean the person can't ask a question, but they don't have any authority to enforce the asking of that question. And I think that was the only question that there was. Now, Senator Ellis had a concern about certain misdemeanors. I had no objection to those misdemeanors as long as they were prioritized below felonies. But my staff tried to chase his staff and wasn't successful in coming up with anything, so I don't know.
Here, what's the status of that? We've got one right here. Senator Ellis just distributed.
Well, I think they did succeed at some point recently.
Well, they got it now. I think I'll grab another copy. Before we move on to that amendment, is there anyone else in the room that would like to testify as concerns the amendment that has been suggested by Senator Halford? We have copies of it here. Basically, all it does, it changes page 6, line 27, by deleting the word subpoena and then inserting issue as subpoena 2. And in the text of the material, what that actually does is say that you cannot issue a subpoena to a judge, justice, or a member of a jury. With that, if there's no one who wishes to testify further on that, further discussion, first we need a motion. Senator Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move, I guess it would be Amendment number 1 by Senator Halford.
Further discussion? Is there objection to the amendment? There being no objection, the amendment is adopted. Senator Ellis, I believe you had an amendment you wished to offer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize. We didn't get it together quickly enough to pass all the copies out, I guess, but hopefully people will have a chance to look at it. These were, and I agree with Senator Halford completely, it would make complete sense that any of these misdemeanors added on, and there are just certain ones of those related to domestic violence, would be prioritized under the more serious crimes that the victim's advocate would deal with. So this would be, these are important things. They would be prioritized lower down the list than the things he started to address with his original bill. Present that to the committee for consideration.
Thank you.
Although we didn't see this until now, it does meet the concerns that I had expressed back to my staff, I think to Senator Ellis' staff, that it would be Class A misdemeanors and it would be a priority system. So this is a good thing. The problem is, do you dilute it to the point of not having enough effect? And I think Senator Ellis' amendment is sensitive to that. So I think the amendment's a positive change.
Mr. Chairman, we'd all, I'd make a commitment, we could all argue against if anyone else had a bright idea to expand this further. I think I would find myself speaking against that, encouraging people not to do that or try and make, jump on this bandwagon to some extent that would cause problems. So this is as far as I would want to go.
Yeah, Mr. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In researching this and looking through, just for example, the question that Senator Ellis asked about who's a victim, I think our laws are still very inadequate in terms of victims' rights. But I think this is a big step in the right direction, and it creates the kind of advocacy that will change those. But basically the person who decides who the victim is, if there are multiple victims, is the prosecutor. The prosecutor can select the weakest victim in terms of advocating for the victims as a group if he chooses to. Now, that's for notification and notice and so forth. But the system really hasn't fleshed out or figured out how that happens. And this is going to be a new area of law. And it's going to take years to really have victims' rights up there right where they belong in all areas and applying all victims. I mean, how do you decide which of the children that lost their mother is the victim to deal with? Those are concerns that are out there.
Well, I certainly share that. I do have one concern, though, and that is by only specifying those violent acts that are misdemeanors, which are domestic violence, are we including through 1141, Senator Ellis, all of your other assault crimes that would be misdemeanors? I mean, not the typical bar brawl, but those assault crimes that are very serious in nature but end up classed as misdemeanors?
Are you saying are we including or excluding?
Including, yeah, that's the question. Are we including them or are they excluded by this?
That was not my intention. I'm sure there's someone here who can speak to that specific point. Jerry Luckup was the drafter. And
the only reason I'm asking is that there are, I've seen a lot of times where he ended up with an assault with a deadly weapon charge. Well, gets reduced to the highest class misdemeanor. I can't remember if that's fourth degree assault or first. I can't remember whether it was one. It is fourth. Yeah. And you end up basically with a felonious situation that gets pled down basically to get rid of the case, and knowing full well that there's going to be a more serious sentence than probably your run-of-the-mill fourth-degree misdemeanor is going to get.
Yeah.
And yet it involves situations that in many times may be much more dangerous or involve a lot more violence than what we would have just within the domestic violence statute itself. So in other words, I don't want to see us say that we're going to take Class A misdemeanors that are really serious Class A misdemeanors, but then we're going to only limit it to those which fall under the definition of domestic violence.
I don't think that's the way it's drafted.
That's why I'm asking. Is 1141 broad enough?
A felony or a Class A misdemeanor, if the Class A misdemeanor is a crime involving domestic violence or a crime against a person under 1141. Well, 1141 is 200 is assault in the first degree. 210 is assault in the second degree. 220 is assault in the third degree.
So it's all the violence against person misdemeanors, basically.
230 is assault in the fourth degree, and now you're getting down to assault in the fourth degree is where you get to the Class A. The first three are felonies. The fourth degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Reckless endangerment is a Class A misdemeanor. Stalking in the first degree is a Class C felony. Second degree is a Class A misdemeanor. So I assume that the drafting style, I'm not sure that was the intent, but it says, or a crime against
the
person under 1141.
Yeah, that's just the last 4 words or 5 words that I was concerned about.
So I guess it does pick up
most of the violent crimes.
Yeah.
Well, if it does that, I think that's fine.
That's okay.
What we're doing is we're building
a good thing bigger, and just we need to know that the problem in any of these things is, in some measure, the size of the fiscal note and the amount of energy you could put into it, because there's $30 million being spent in the combination of the other side of these same issues.
And I guess that's been my concern all along, is that $14 a barrel oil, where are we going to find the money and the people to do it? Not our question here. That will be reserved for a higher body.
But the priority is still to felony cases in the rest of the language of this amendment.
Well, that answers my concern. Have you moved the amendment, Senator Ellis?
I have not, but I've moved amendment number two.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify now that the amendment is before us as concerns the amendment? Appearing. Is there any objection or further discussion, I should say, on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? There being no objection, the amendment passes. Are there anyone here who would like to testify about the bill in general as now amended? Mr. Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I apologize for not being at the last hearing on this bill. I was double booked, or actually triple booked, in other legislative hearings. I did, however, get a copy of the tape of the hearing, and over the weekend I listened to that, and so I'm aware of the testimony that was presented and some of the concerns that the committee members had. Let me just start out by saying, first of all, that the Criminal Division of the Department of Law in the late 1970s and early 1980s was among the first jurisdictions in the country to establish a victim witness assistance program. We hired paralegals in most of our offices to deal with victims and witnesses, to get them to court, to inform them about the nature of the proceedings. We've been involved in ongoing training over that period of time, and we've been very happy with the support the legislature has provided for our victim witness program. Having said that, let me point out, we held a district attorney's and paralegal's conference late last year. Here's the material for that conference. It was devoted to sexual assault cases and sexual assault victims. We had speakers from around the country. Among the topics were the effect of sexual assault on victims, interviewing and preparing the victim for court, sexual assault response teams, victims' rights, stalking and its effect on victims, and there was a panel discussion on working together to better serve victims. 2 years ago, our conference, again for paralegals and attorneys, was devoted to domestic violence and its effect on victims. If we have one later this year, it will be devoted to cases dealing with child victims. Our focus in recent years has been towards dealing with victims better. And I think that initially our emphasis on dealing with victims was for two reasons. One, it was the right thing to do. But second, it just helps us out in our criminal cases. In the late 1970s, the first criminal justice computer systems were really getting going and developing statistics on why cases were won and lost. And to no one's surprise, one of the primary factors was degree of cooperation between victims, witnesses, and the prosecution. So it really helps us in prosecuting cases to deal with victims appropriately. Now, having said that, I think the testimony that you heard at the hearing last week that the victims sometimes don't get notice of hearings, that sometimes they feel they aren't treated appropriately, that didn't come as any surprise to me, and I'll tell you why. I think the conclusions that you can draw from that, we may differ about that, but it didn't come as much of a surprise. I think there are a couple of factors initially that I'd like to point out to you. First, are sheer numbers, and Senator Halperd alluded to the fact that there are a lot of numbers of cases. Every year, the Criminal Division Department of Law gets sent by police agencies about 3,000 felony cases involving crimes with victims, about 6,000 misdemeanor cases. If you add on cases handled by a municipality of Anchorage, municipality of Juneau, you're over 10,000 cases involving victims. Not all of those are prosecuted, but roughly two-thirds are. So you're dealing with about 6,000 victims. In each of those cases, you usually have at least one other witness in the case. It's a police officer, an eyewitness, or something like that. So in other words, just to get people to court and inform them where they have to be, you're dealing with about 12,000 people. The very simplest misdemeanor case is going to involve at least three hearings, an initial appearance where bail is sometimes discussed, entry of plea where an attorney is appointed and represents them and bail is also discussed, and a change of plea. And this assumes there's no trial, nothing else, but three hearings in the simplest misdemeanor case. In the simplest felony case, you're likely to have five hearings, initial arraignment, entry of plea in the district court, then superior court arraignment after an indictment, then change of plea, and then there is a separate sentencing hearing in felony court. So that's five hearings, assuming no trial, and assuming that those hearings aren't postponed or continued for a variety of reasons, which often happens. What you're left with, let's say 12,000 people that have to get to court times four hearings, you're looking at upwards of 50,000 contacts that we have to make every year just to get people to court on time. Let them know what's going on, inform them what their role is in those proceedings. And frankly, that's extraordinarily difficult for the limited staff that we have. And things are going to happen. Every once in a while, cases are going to fall through the cracks and someone isn't going to be notified. Sometimes we get very short notice of some of these hearings. We've had problems with the court system, and I'll be describing that a little later. And I don't think the Office of Victim Advocacy is going to help in that regard. I wouldn't expect it to. What we use, we have a lot of brochures that we give out to victims, letting them know letting them know a little bit about the court system, letting them know a little bit about what their rights are. Got one, what families should know about child sexual abuse. The Judicial Council has a handbook for victims of crime in Alaska. We're putting out new editions of these brochures. They're at the printers right now. We're having them translated into UBIC so that they will be available to many parts of the state and rural Alaska as well. So the numbers, but the numbers are just, that's just one part of the situation. Another aspect of dealing with victims really involves the victims themselves and the trauma that they have to go through. Victims are people to whom terrible things happen to them. There is nothing that we as prosecutors, really anybody in the criminal justice system can do to make them whole. Not even if we get complete restitution in a burglary case, there's still the idea of your privacy in your home has been violated. We can't undo what has been done to them. And it's particularly acute, I think, in homicide cases where someone has died. I mean, we can't bring them back. Oftentimes, with victims, there are other things going on in their lives that put an immense amount of pressure on them. And it simply is a fact of life in the criminal justice system that victims are often, because of the trauma of the crime itself or the other things going on in their lives, not able to adequately process the information they are given. Or if they are able to process and understand it, not really able to deal with it in the course of their lives. And that's another reason why we use the brochures, because once they have something like this in their hand, they are able to use it at the period of time when they're most psychologically able to deal with that. Now, to the extent that the Office of Victim Advocacy can help in that regard, to letting people know what their rights are, helping them deal with it, I think that's a good thing. I think it's going to be very difficult for the office to do that, but I think that's a good thing. I do want to make a comment about some of the testimony you heard about this particular Fairbanks murder case. It was a triple murder. Three people died. There were two of the people who died were students in Fairbanks. They were from out of state. Their families were from out of state. We kept in contact, close contact with them, let them know about the course of proceedings. The professor, college professor himself, you heard from his ex-wife. They were divorced at the time. And we treated her as a victim in the case, even though they weren't married at the time. He had a fiance. He was going to get married. We treated her as a victim. He had a grown daughter from a previous, another marriage. We treated her as a victim. We could have, under the statute, chosen one person to represent all of us, but we didn't. And so we were notifying multiple people during that time. I think it's really, I don't want to go into private details about the lives of the witnesses you heard, but let me just say that there were other very serious things going on in their lives that affected their ability to process and comprehend the information we were given. One of the things that Karen Johnston said, the ex-wife of the murdered professor, said, and she was very angry about it. She struggled for 7 months to get even a tiny bit of information about the crime. And she said she was rebuffed by the DA's office and told that she couldn't learn that information until after the case was done. Now, when you heard that testimony, you may have thought that the prosecutor's office has done something wrong. The prosecutor's office dropped the ball. When I heard that testimony, I thought to myself, she sounds like she wants to get copies of the police reports. Sounds to me like the DA's office did precisely the correct thing that was required to do under the law, and basically saying, sorry, you can't see that until after the case is concluded. Because victims have no greater rights than anybody else to view confidential information, such as police reports in this case. The public record statutes don't allow us to turn this information over. If we do, I believe that there are we have ethical problems with the rules of professional conduct. Under the rules of professional conduct as attorneys, we have to even make efforts to stop the police from doing those things that would be violations of attorneys to them. So I heard that, and I said to myself, the DA's office was doing the right thing. But was she able to comprehend why it had to be like that, the reasons for that, the specific legal reasons and ethical reasons? I don't think so, assuming it was even explained to her in that level of detail. So I think that it's in many cases, these people are simply not able to comprehend the information we give them. And frankly, sometimes we give them too much information. I don't want to get into if you want me to respond to the things that were said, I have responses to all of them, but I don't think that it's necessary at this point. I reviewed what our actions in that case. I talked to the paralegal who handled that case. She's one of the best ones we have in the state, the sweetest, most caring individual you could imagine. And I am satisfied, based on my review of that case and the records that I have seen and the letters that I have seen going out, that we did everything that we could have to treat all of those people, every one of them, fairly and with respect. I have a couple of points to make about how the Office of Victim Advocacy could help out in criminal cases. I've got 2 points to make about how, depending on how it's run, it might inadvertently end up hurting some criminal cases. And I've got a couple of things for you to consider. As I indicated, to the extent that this office can explain the law to victims in perhaps more detail than we have time to the extent that they can help them through their trauma, I think that's a good thing. I think that's terrific. That's one point. To the extent that, as advocates, they can help protect victims against unfair defense attorney tactics, I think that's a very good thing. This legislature adopted legislation to limit the kind of tactics that defense attorneys sometimes use with victims, secretly tape recording their conversations, not letting them know who they're talking to, misrepresenting who they are. To the extent that this office can help and curb some of those practices, I think that's great. A couple of points where might end up inadvertently hurting some of our cases. There are 2 classes of cases in particular, domestic violence being one and child sexual abuse being another, where the victims oftentimes feel immense pressure to recant their testimony after it's been given, either to the police or the grand jury. In domestic violence cases, it comes at the hands of their abuser. The dynamics of domestic violence situations result in a lot of recantations and a lot of pressure on victims to recant. When they recant, when they're being pressured to recant, they often come to the prosecutor and say, please dismiss this case. You know, my husband promises not to do this again. Our policy is not to do that. We believe that it's better that the victims get better protection ultimately if the offender is held accountable for his actions and gets the right kind of counsel. But oftentimes the victims not only are unwilling to cooperate, not only want to take back their testimony, they oftentimes leave the jurisdiction, violate the subpoena. To the extent that they would use the victim advocate to facilitate those actions where they would not have to testify, where they would, for example, we have had victims say, well, I told the grand jury that he assaulted me, but I don't mean it. I was lying. And if you want me to testify, you're going to have to give me immunity for my perjury at the grand jury. So all of a sudden, we have to immunize these people. To the extent that an attorney is available to facilitate that, I think that's damaging to our efforts. The same kind of thing happens with child sexual abuse, where it's not the child, it's one parent who may be supportive of the child abuser, putting pressure on the child to recant the testimony or to not testify at all. To the extent that there is facilitation of that, I think that could be very harmful. Another area, and this depends on how this advocate is going to approach his or her job. I mean, I think there are different philosophies. If this is strictly a client, you have an attorney-client relationship, and you're going to do whatever the client wants, I think that could potentially cause us problems. If this advocate is going to fully advise the victims about, you know, all of their rights and perhaps all of their civil remedies and talks, for example, about possible civil recovery in a civil case, that opens the victims up to a line of cross-examination that, frankly, we don't see very often. I mean, right now, if a victim goes to the office of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board and asks for compensation, something that they've been authorized to do for years, that subjects a line of cross-examination that essentially makes them out to be money-grubbing and looking for money in this case. I think that depending on what they're advised by the advocate, it could open up lines of cross-examination that might be unfortunate. There is a statute that says, it's 1261.110b, that says the law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, corrections agencies, social service agencies, and the court shall make every reasonable effort to ensure that victims of crimes have the rights set out in this section. And we take that seriously. I'd like to just quickly go over some cases that we have pursued just in the last year where solely to uphold victims' rights, not because they have any relationship to our ability to prosecute a case, not because dealing with admissibility of evidence or anything else, but solely to uphold victims' rights that we have pursued in the appellate courts. Now, what happens is many times things happen to victims or courts issue rulings in the middle of a case. We can't wait till the end of the case to appeal. The state really has no right to appeal in most instances. We have to take a petition to the Court of Appeals right then. It usually has to be done within that day or the next day. And the Court of Appeals doesn't have to hear these matters. But let me just go over a couple of these cases we've done in the last year, and I think it's going to illustrate my next point. First one is State versus Minahan. This was a case in which a woman was brutally beaten by her boyfriend, serious facial injuries, broken bones, had to undergo surgery. As a result of the beating, lost a lot of her memory. The court in Fairbanks issued an order that she undergo a battery of psychological tests as a result of that, and the defense expert said that he could tell from these neurological tests whether she was even telling the truth, I mean, sort of a human lie detector. As a result of this case, which was pending last year, you passed a statute prohibiting this kind of thing. We had filed a petition with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals took the petition that was pending at the time the legislation passed. The Court of Appeals ultimately in December issued an opinion and did the right thing. They said that the Superior Court had abused its discretion and shouldn't have done that. So the Court of Appeals in that case did the right thing, but it was our effort to get that to that level. Another case which we just took up recently involved a domestic violence situation in a rural Alaska village. On very short notice, about 2 hours' notice, the court held a bail hearing. All the prosecutors were in court. Our paralegals were scrambling around trying to get notice to the victim, ultimately couldn't do it. And we said to the judge, look, judge, the victim has a right to be here under the Constitution and laws of the state of Alaska, a right to be in every proceeding where the defendant is present. And we think that this hearing should be postponed until you can hear from the victim about whether this person should be released. Court said, nope, my schedule doesn't allow it, and I'm not going to do it. So we took a petition up to the Court of Appeals, and a 2-1 decision, they disagreed. They said the judge had that discretion. Now, Judge Mannheimer said, look, I think this is a serious issue. I think this is an important issue. The constitutional laws say that victims have these rights. The statute says that the court system shall use every reasonable effort to ensure these rights. I think it's a case we ought to take, but they didn't take it. Next case involves the murder of Trooper Heck. In that case, the defense has been postponing. It's going on. The trial is going on right now, but the defense has been postponing the case numerous times. For one of the postponements, the court granted the defense the opportunity to have basically a closed door hearing, just the defense and the judge, ex parte, in camera hearing. Latin phrases meaning secret. We said, look, I mean, you can't do this. The family has been waiting to get this case to trial. We wanted to get it to trial. It's an abuse of your discretion to hold these secret hearings just for the purposes of a continuance. And in this case, petition to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did the right thing and said it's an abuse of discretion. Let's get going. Earlier in that case, however, at the very beginning of the Trooper Heck murder case, the defense wanted to postpone the funeral, postpone the cremation of the body until they could get their own pathologist up to do an autopsy. And we postponed that for several days to allow them to get their expert. They say they called all over the country trying to find an expert and couldn't get one. And they wanted to continue to postpone the autopsy even after we gave them a several-day continuance. We said, look, the funeral is all set. The cremation is set. The family has to get on with their lives, and this is important to the healing process. We took this up to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals said no, the judge is right in giving them the continuance. So the Court of Appeals didn't do the right thing that time. Case involving John Titus versus the state of Alaska, Fort Yukon elder who was convicted of rape after a very contentious trial in the community. The Superior Court judge ultimately decided not to get a new trial. We said we took it up to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said no, we shouldn't get a new trial. In the meantime, he's released on bail. The defense then is taking that issue up to the Alaska Supreme Court, and this guy is out on bail, even though there's a statute that says when you're convicted of this type of crime, pending appeal, you should not be out on bail. And so the legislature last year had to pass a statute to counteract this kind of situation. And finally, we've got a case that's on appeal right now where a judge in Anchorage did the right thing, lower court judge did the right thing, and said, the Constitution says that victims have a right to be present whenever the defendant is. I'm going to allow this victim to be present during the trial. The defense took that up to the Court of Appeals and says, as a matter of due process of law, it's unfair to allow victims in there to hear the testimony. And even though we have a statute now that, that clearly allows that, this is a constitutional issue. This case is up on appeal. Now, what I've gone through here with several cases, you know, sort of like the Court of Appeals does the right thing, and then they don't rule for us, and they rule for us, and they rule against us, and they rule for us. Any guesses on how they're going to come out on this one? I don't know, honestly. My point is that if you really want to make progress in victims' rights, you should not allow that progress to be made through the development of case law at the appellate court level in Alaska. I simply do not have confidence that that case law would develop quickly or would develop predictably. And I heard Senator Halford say a number of times last week that one of the intents was that the case law develop through the appellate court process and that this office would be able to help in that regard. I mean, I think this office will be able to help in that regard, but I really urge you, if you want to see victims' rights progress, that it not be by leaving it to the development of Alaska case law, because it's just not going to happen the way I think that you want. I mean, for example, I mean, if you think that victims ought to be given access to police reports, you know, if they keep them confidential and all that, that's a good thing to have. We will never get that through through appellate case law. That, I believe, can only be done through through statutory change. And so I guess my final comment is that if development of victims' rights is really the ultimate intent, I think it can probably be better done by a comprehensive set of statutes. We've got a pretty good start. I mean, we've got a table of victims' rights statutes. They're, some of them are consolidated in Title 12. Some of them are scattered throughout. Some of them apply to some types of cases and not to other types of cases. It's kind of confusing. I think that a good comprehensive look at that is really warranted, and I urge you to do that. So that is my testimony. That's my response to what I heard at the last hearing, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, sir. I have on the teleconference in Anchorage Barbara Brink with the Public Defender Office. Barbara, did you wish to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, please, very briefly. My name is Barbara Brink. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. I would also like to apologize for not being present at the last hearing. I, like Mr. Guanelli, was in another legislative hearing. I really don't have anything to add regarding the substantive content of the bill. I believe that Mr. Guanelli has done a good job addressing some of what I usually call the unintended consequences, results that might occur that we haven't thought of when we supply the victim with an attorney. I did receive some information that questions may have arisen during the last hearing regarding allocation of resources within the Public Defender Agency. And so I am here simply, Mr. Chairman, to make myself available to address any concerns that were brought up at the last hearing or any concerns regarding allocation of resources members of the committee might have at this hearing. I believe there was some reference to hiring two attorneys to handle some case. I'm sorry, I did not have the ability to listen to the tape, so I don't know exactly what the question was. But I just wanted to let the committee know that I'm certainly here to answer any questions or concerns about how we allocate resources. Thank you.
Were there any questions for Barbara? Senator Halford is here, and I think he could tell you about the case he was concerned about.
Yeah, the case I asked about was the current case, the Stavanger case, where an attorney was hired by the family before the individual turned himself in. That attorney was then hired by you, apparently, as outside counsel after he was found to be indigent. Then his family turned around and hired another attorney for him. At some point, you know, when are you indigent? If your family can turn around and give you an attorney, do you still have the right to have a state attorney?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Halford. I'm very happy to answer that question because that simply is a misunderstanding. In fact, you're right. Mr. Stavanger did hire private counsel before he turned himself in, and then once a determination was made that he was indigent, we were appointed. The family and private counsel both contacted me asking if we could work out some kind of joint arrangement, pointing out that it would certainly be cost-effective to hire private counsel who had already been heavily invested in the case to work alongside the public defender, But in fact, I said flatly no. I had exactly the same question that you did. I said, you are either indigent and entitled to our services, or you are not indigent and you don't get our services. And so the family made the decision to marshal their resources, and they decided to continue hiring private counsel. The public defender is not involved in that case in any way, shape, or form. And that was the only way I could see, given the same concerns that you and I both had, to handle the matter. Either you're indigent and my agency represents you, or you have resources and you should get your own lawyer.
Thank you for that answer, and I think it's the right one.
Thank you.
Any further questions or comments to Barbara? Thank you, Barbara. I appreciate your taking the time to be online. Fred, did you wish to testify also?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brant McKee. I'm the Director of the Office of Public Advocacy, and I'm certainly not here speaking on behalf of the administration. I do have one small concern, and I would have raised it in teleconference, but I happen to be in town today. And that is the potential for confusion between my agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, and the new agency, the Office of Victims Advocacy. I can't tell you how much confusion and frustration and delay that will cause people. I can't tell you that. I know that it will cause some. The legislators and public agency lawyers deal with clients and constituents and their families every day, and I know from that experience that there is a great deal of confusion among the public about the roles played by the different alphabet agencies that we all know because we deal with them daily, but the average citizen just has no reason to know those things. So I would suggest respectfully that you consider another name for it, the Office of Victims' Rights Council, some other designation that can't be confused, Office of Public Advocacy, Office of Victims Advocacy, OPA, OVA. If there could be just a different title to it, I think we'd avoid that particular problem. Like I say, it's a small concern. I have no idea how much confusion that's going to cause in the coming years, but I do know that it will cause some, and it may be worthwhile avoiding.
You can change the existing one to the Office of Criminal Advocacy.
Right. You can change it to the Office of Children's Advocacy because that's our primary mission.
That's where you do most of the work. Yeah. The number of people that I've had contact me over the years confused about the designation of the Office of Judicial Conduct and the Judicial Council. Just that one alone is huge. So I understand that. Do you have any problem with removing the word advocate, Senator Alford, and inserting the word Office of Victims' Rights as opposed?
Not at all. And he's right.
I don't know how many times that would have to appear or whatever in here, and I don't. We're going to have to get a CS anyhow, I'm assuming. But I would make that as a conceptual amendment that the title be changed to Office of Victims' Rights. I don't even know if that's going to help all that much, Brad, but I appreciate the thought behind it.
Thanks very much.
Hopefully if we can remove any part of confusion out there to the public on what we do, it's a better day.
Thank you very much.
Is there objection to that motion? There being no objection, we will do that conceptual amendment. And you'll have to have the drafters take care of that, Rob. Anyone who wishes to testify further on the bill? Yes, Laura.
Record. My name is Laurie Huguenin, and I'm the director of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to let you know what's going on in the nonprofit local community world in terms of victims advocacy and legal advocacy. 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago now, we did a statewide survey of victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, asking them what their number one need was in terms of being able to get safe or to have their needs met, and overwhelmingly it was legal advocacy. It was a lack of legal representation or help in being able to maneuver through the criminal justice system. In response to that, after Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, now Alaska is fortunate to receive some federal dollars through actually three different grants to strengthen victim services. One of those is a STOP grant in which we use for a legal advocacy project. So in 23 communities across the state, There are trained legal advocates that have been receiving training for about a year now, and we're following that up with some teleconferences and some face-to-face training to help victims of domestic violence and sexual assault be able to wind their way through the criminal justice system. As also part of that federal grant, through the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, a paralegal coordinator has been hired that works with the victim witness coordinators in each of the district attorney's offices to help better prepare victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And with a mandatory arrest grant, there's been a volunteer coordinator that's been hired to work with advocacy programs to get volunteers into prosecutors' offices, both at the state and the municipal level, to assist victims as they need to go through the process. So I wanted to let you be aware of that and some of the projects that are ongoing at a community level. We also have started a pro bono project, and our goal is to be able to have in communities that have courts and that have advocacy programs that have victims come through the courts, attorneys who would be willing to donate parts of their time for one case or maybe two or three different cases. We're also working on an AmeriCorps project to partner with the National AmeriCorps Corporation to provide one person for each advocacy agency in the state to be able to free up time so there would be a full-time legal advocate available for women as they need to go through the process. And with the second part of some federal funding that won't be available until next year, we're going to start working on a court translator project. One of the identified needs for victims in being able to fairly access the court and exercise their rights is a language barrier and not being able to understand the proceedings that go forward in English. So that's also a project that's going to be happening. And as you're going through thinking about the Office of Victims' Rights and funding that, if there was a way to further support these volunteer local community efforts that are going on or augment some of the federal funding that's happening, I think to better be able to help victims at the local level, we're going to be able to serve more people more often than not. And I guess the only concern really that the network has with a centralized victim rights agency is it's just going to be overwhelmed. And we appreciate being able to have misdemeanor domestic violence cases added in and other crimes against a person added in. It may be later, and as they're setting up their policies and procedures or regulations, that we would want to have some clear discussion about the kinds of issues that they are going to take and boundaries. I think it would be a disservice to victims if they assumed by having this state agency available that they were going to be able to be represented in court all the time. And I don't know that, you know, that's being set up. But I think that when we hear, when I heard Janice speak last week, one of the things she said is this victim would now be able to have an attorney. And we would just want to be careful with that. So I just wanted to let you know what was going on.
I don't believe that's going to happen, not with the limited budget and personnel that we're looking at right now. They already have an attorney there. It's a district attorney. And this person is supposed to be assisting that victim get through this process, making certain that their constitutional rights, as we've amended our Constitution, are protected. Unfortunately, as you and I both know, the workload out there is going to be so horrendous. Be very difficult for these people to do much other than triage when it comes to the major crimes, and probably they will end up making some form of protocols and selection process of their own to try and make certain they get to those areas that have been really horrible situations for victims and take care of them first and then move on down the ladder. It's wonderful to hear about the networking that's gone on and the work that your groups are doing. That's fantastic. But hopefully this just adds another person or two that can help out in that battle. Did you have anything else?
No, and I didn't want to take up a lot of your time. I just wanted you to be aware of what was going on at a local level.
Was there anyone else who wanted to testify? Senator Halford.
Just one thing that kind of applies to the entry level. It's not that you're a victim. It's that you're a victim who has been denied your constitutional rights.
That's right.
You have to go forward to that point. It's not a matter of providing attorneys
for all victims.
Encourage people or find ways for domestic violence victims to mess up the case, because the do now and don't want to see that change. But you don't get to that point with this advocate by either workload, intent, or anything else. Because the entry level is the right to have been violated by one constitution.
One of the main concerns I have, Senator Halford, as you know, is the outcome of a hearing I held in Fairbanks not too long ago. And for the life of me, I cannot yet explain to any of those people, and I'm embarrassed by this, why we end up with 1,100 victims, the largest fraud scheme ever perpetrated against Alaskans, and not one single one of those victims has yet seen a criminal prosecution brought against the perpetrator against them. And until such time as my Attorney General's office can answer that question to me, I think this legislature and the enforcement bodies of this state on criminal law deserve, those people deserve a tremendous apology from us.
Senator Hillary, I have a constitutional amendment proposal that can fix
it. I agree.
If you're asking for a response, I'm certainly prepared to give you one right now. If we can do it, another time.
Well, it seems relevant and applicable to me under the law that we're currently changing, or talking about changing. We're talking about victims and who will advocate for them when the district attorney's office does not.
Let me go back just a few years. In the mid-80s, there was an audit done of the finances of the North Slope Borough, discovered widespread fraud and corruption involving public officials and a number of in-state and out-of-state corporations. As a result of state criminal division and state troopers' initial look at that, we quickly decided that the scope of that particular case, its interstate nature, and the fact that the federal authorities, particularly the IRS, were already investigating, made it appropriate to turn the prosecution of that case over to the federal authorities, and we actually helped them out extensively in giving them attorney assistance. That case was successfully prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. Jail sentences were imposed. With this particular case that you're referring to, it involved a travel agency that said that it was buying a frequent flyer miles at discount. They needed a lot of cash to do that, and so they borrowed money from people at exorbitant interest rates, paid back the initial investors, and as more and more people got in on the deal, it quickly fell apart. Sort of a classic, what they call a Ponzi scheme. You pay back the initial investors, encourage more people to come in and start collecting money. The 1,100 cases involved victims from all over the country, in many other states. This particular individual who operated this scheme also was conducting operations in other states. Had actually registered made application to register in Idaho and Nevada that I'm aware of. The attorney who was advising this person ended up leaving the country, and I'm not sure, we still know where he is. At the time, the state prosecutors were advised of this scam. There was already a bankruptcy investigation going on, federal bankruptcy. Custodian had been appointed. There was already an IRS investigation, and IRS search warrants had already been issued. In fact, subsequently, some of those IRS search warrants have been challenged in federal court, and there is ongoing federal litigation over the adequacy of those IRS investigations. It was clear at an early point in time that the federal authorities would, in fact, take over that investigation. As I said, the IRS was already involved. I sat down personally with U.S. Attorney Bob Bundy at an early point in time, and it was decided that it was clear that the feds had better laws, mail fraud and wire fraud in particular, better sentencing provisions. To the extent that there are any assets remaining anywhere in the country or the world, they are certainly in a better position to trace those assets and collect restitution for the victims. The feds had more money, more investigative resources. As I indicated, there are victims all over the country, and this is a multi-state fraud. So there were good practical reasons for letting the U.S. Attorney's Office handle the case. As far as the legal reasons go, parallel investigations are not a good idea. The IRS had many documents in that case. The IRS doesn't talk, as a matter of practice, to state investigators. It's like pulling teeth to get any information out of them. When there are parallel investigations going on and the investigators don't know what the others know, there is a risk of a great deal of damage being done to either one of the other investigations. Investigations have to go on with a common strategy, tactics, and understanding about what is going on. The other legal issue that was involved at the time was that as a result of a joint state-federal narcotics investigation that had arisen out of a bank robbery and a murder and a drug case, the federal authorities had cut a deal with one of the participants, said, you know, we want you to testify against your co-defendant, says, okay, I'll testify with immunity, and was granted immunity in the federal courts. Then for the bank robbery. Then the issue becomes, in state court, we were prosecuting a murder case because murder is generally not a federal crime. In prosecuting the murder case, what evidence can the state prosecute this person at all? He's been given immunity in federal courts. Federal courts, you only get immunity for the use of your testimony. It's use immunity. In state courts, we have a rule that gives you transactional immunity. It's complete, total immunity. And the issue was, because this person has been given immunity in the federal courts, does that mean that, in essence, he has been given complete immunity in the state courts? And the lower court, the trial court, held yes and dismissed our murder indictment against that person. So at the time we were going time we learned about this case, we had the law, at least at the Superior Court level in Alaska, being if the feds give immunity to anybody in this investigation, the state will not be able to prosecute that person at all. Because we couldn't find out what the feds were doing, we were in a position of going forward with an investigation basically blindfolded, and that was not appropriate either. Since that time, 18 months later, our Court of Appeals ruled that federal immunity only gives you comparable immunity, use immunity in state court, but at the time, we had a Superior Court ruling to the contrary. The other risk that we face in proceeding with a state prosecution is the different rules of criminal discovery. In other words, how much information can the defendant obtain from the prosecution? As you know, in state court, discovery is total. I mean, the prosecution has to give over to the defense everything that it has. In federal court, it's quite the contrary. The feds have to give over very little in the way of evidence. So if the state had gone forward with a prosecution for fraud or theft, let's say, under state statutes, probably at most a B felony, we risked having to turn over information that would have jeopardized the federal prosecution because the feds would not have wanted that information turned over. So there were a whole series of both practical and legal reasons why it was inappropriate for the state to be involved in that. The one that the papers picked up on and kind of trumpeted as the headline was there happened to be some people who were involved in as some of the early investors in this scheme, and you know many of them are victims as well. But because the Department of Law was had those individuals involved, there was also an appearance. Even if we went forward as appointing a special prosecutor, there would always still be the idea that well, if you appointed the special prosecutor knowing that some of your employees are involved, and there would be this cloud. I mean, I don't believe that there was any real threat that we would not undertake a vigorous prosecution, but because of all the practical, legal, and appearance problems, it was decided early on, and actually at the request of the U.S. attorney, we did not get involved in the case in favor of allowing the feds to go forward. And as you know, there's a federal indictment, and I believe the trial is scheduled for this summer. Those are the reasons. I think they're sound legal and practical reasons. And to the extent that hasn't been adequately communicated to to everyone, I think that's unfortunate. And I'm not certain what we can do about that.
Are any of the Department of Law employees under indictment?
No.
Okay. I was certain there was lots of reasons for why it wasn't done. I think it's unfortunate that the headlines were what they were, but I still think there is an underlying sense of betrayal, if you will, on the part of those people. Now, of the 1,100, yes, there are maybe a couple hundred that are out of state. Most of them are right here in the state. And one of the biggest beneficiaries of this fraud scheme is one of our employees. Looking at the numbers, his go into six digits. And when Larry Carroll resigns his position as the state's investigator because the prosecutor's office failed to prosecute the biggest fraud case he'd ever brought to them, I think that raises serious questions. I'm sure there are many good reasons why the department did what it did. But the public perception of that, at least the perception to those victims, is such that they went to their state troopers. They took $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 bad checks to their state trooper, only to be told they weren't going to do anything about it, and not to be told what was going on. And as far as they know, to this day, no state prosecution has been brought against this person at any time on any charge. Now, why did the state of Idaho prosecutor end up with a conviction for which she was under probation when she came to this state? Doesn't my state talk to the state of Idaho? I mean, I guarantee you, when somebody wants to find out my background information, they'll pick up a computer, they'll zip through it, they'll go right into NCIC, they'll know everything about me. And if I'm convicted of any crime in Idaho, it'll come glaring up on the computer. We seem to be able to use these computers for all kinds of other things, but we don't seem to be able to use them when it comes to protecting Alaskans. And for the life of me, I don't understand all this yet, but I am going to hold an additional hearing or two on it. And I hope that things are just as you said, Mr. Guinelli. I hope that there are lots of good, valid, justifiable reasons for why this wasn't done. I think the time frame upon when Mr. Carroll's report was rendered to your office and when decisions had been made by the IRS, that's my understanding the IRS hasn't prosecuted her yet. In fact, it's my understanding from some of the victims that they've heard that the IRS held off on prosecution because the longer the scheme ran, the higher the amount of taxes are that would be owed by those victims. And in fact, the IRS is prosecuting those victims right now on their tax returns, asking for payment of taxes on the amount of money they allegedly were to receive but actually never received, many of them. So they're not only being taxed there, but they're being sued by the master in bankruptcy for double damages because of the usury aspect of the contract that she drafted, the perpetrator drafted for them to sign. Now, these are not all victims. Some of these people came out well ahead. Some of them were our employees that came out well ahead. And I think when that occurs, I think we have to have more of a response than we had and at a quicker time. My concern is that we've got some lengthy time periods that occur here from the time these issues were first raised. We have letters written by state employees at the time, claiming everything she's doing is fine, and they were some of the biggest winners in the fraud scheme. And that one is just tough for the public, I think, to eat. You know,
Senator, I can't disagree with you that the public perception is that, you know, the ball was dropped, and we could have certainly done a better job explaining all of the reasons.
Well, and part of my concern is if we're going to act as a judiciary committee and provide any type of daylight on these kinds of subjects, and they're painful when you have to go through them for all parties, we may at the same time further enhance the state's liability. And that also causes me grave concern because now, from some of the information that has been developed, we find the state's being sued by some of these people. And these cases could have serious magnitude as far as the potential liability of the state in this decision process. So it's obviously one that carries a lot of different ramifications to it, but I do appreciate your explanation and your testimony because if we truly are to be concerned about victims and advocating for victims, and I raised that point, if you'll remember, during the first discussion on this bill, and that's the right of nulla prosequi, and I certainly believe that's a very important thing to have, and yet at the same time, I believe I'm the only person that voted to keep the law in place that would allow for for an individual to bring a criminal charge of prosecution when the state failed to do so. Now, that law was eliminated about 11, 12 years ago because people were using it as a harassment technique on various officers, especially down the Kenai Peninsula. I still think that maybe we need to have something, some avenue or opportunity available for the victims to be heard from when and if the state decides, for whatever reason, not to move forward with the prosecution. Maybe this this bill will provide us at least with some reports and some ideas on where we're going to go.
Thank you for the opportunity to respond.
Thank you. Were there anyone else who wished to testify? If not, I'm prepared to move the bill at this time. Senator Miller, thank you for coming back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I moved Senate Bill 219 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Yeah, that would be a motion to move committee substitute.
Or committee substitute, right.
219.
That's right, as amended.
And that bill will be placed in final form and brought back to each of you before you sign on the recommendations. I want you to see the amendments that have been made. Are there any objections? There being no objection, the bill moves to committee. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.